Sweeney's Bothy on Egg feels like a fitting place to come to finish a collection of stories that explore other ways to win. My task was to write an autobiographical account for a publishing house whose strapline is inspiring adventure. The thought of doing that initially made me feel a bit squeamish. I thought I might have some entertaining stories to tell that could even offer up a different perspective, but the idea of writing a chronological memoir of my life felt self-indulgent at best and megalomaniacal at worst. So I wrote this book for myself in the same spirit as I hope each individual who picks it up interprets it, with their own bias and background. Spoiler alert, there is no definitive way to win. My only hope is that these stories inspire some sort of personal reflection on what winning means for each of us, but also what it means to us as part of something much bigger and wilder and timeless. The sky here has now separated itself from the earth, and the sea is beginning to separate itself from the sky. All three are variations on the colour blue. The wind hasn't dropped one wee bit, but its soundtrack is now enhanced by the shadows of the whipping bare birch branches outside. Rum is revealed, impossibly close and oppressively high. The room is warm and my porridge is ready. I'll leave you to your own reality now.
Back, should we go back the way we came and see if we can get back up that way? I should get myself a mountain bike. It'd be much easier.
Why?
Why did you feel, oh, time to write a book?
Oh,
I'm starting there.
Why did I feel time to write a book?
Well, it wasn't actually quite like that.
How did it happen?
Vertebrae asked, would I be interested in writing something? So the publisher asked if I'd be interested because I'd contributed to a women's anthology they published.
Right.
And I'd always written stuff, and I already had a big backlog of stories that I'd already written and wanted to tell. And I thought, well, that's easy. I'll just shove them all as chapters.
Was that it? You had those stories pretty much done?
No. That's what I thought, Simon. No, that is not what happened, because then it was another, like, 6 years or something in the creation. It wasn't quite as straightforward as that at all. Because that's actually not how a book comes together. And they wanted a memoir, and the thought of creating a memoir filled me with horror.
Yeah.
It just felt really sort of self-indulgent, and all of that focus being just on me and my chronological story of my life, it just didn't feel right. But then I read Maggie O'Farrell's memoir, I Am, I Am, I Am. You read that?
I haven't.
Absolutely brilliant. So what she does is she tells little snapshots that you can dip in and out of, just tell chapters of her life, but also have like a point to them, or a theme that runs through them all. And I thought, well, what's the most important thing to me in my life is exploring the value of things and making the world a better place. I thought, if we can somehow weave that through all of these stories and knit together this theme, then
interesting,
maybe there's a book in that.
Interesting that was actually the motivation right at the start, because it's clear that it's there. Right.
Well, it wasn't right at the start, was it? Because I remember just a moment ago I said, great, I'll just shove together all the stories I read.
No, but when
that
you said,
came.
Right, okay. So was that just having a good editor who said, no, you can't do it that way?
I had a great editor, Kirsty at Vertebrae. She was brilliant. She did help me sort of try to figure out the structure when I explained that the idea of a memoir filled me with horror. She was really, really helpful.
Did you know how much to share? Because you get quite personal in this.
I do get personal. I think you sort of owe that to your audience. If I'm not going to give a little bit of myself, then why would anyone give up their time to read it?
Fair enough. But still, you don't strike me as someone who, who's forever on Instagram or Facebook talking about your innermost.
Absolutely.
Thoughts.
No, you're right. And although there are some really personal parts to that book, it's all a choice. Like, I've thought quite hard about the stuff that I want to share. There's nothing I've put out in that book that I was still sort of working through as a process, or I feel vulnerable about putting out to the world. Everything in that book was written because I hoped that it might speak to other people and
help connect with other people and make people feel like they're maybe not alone in the harder bits, that we all go through the stuff that I talked about in that book at some level or other. It's not unique, my experience isn't, well, yeah, of course it's unique to me, but you know, everybody has these feelings, and I think if we don't speak up about them, then we feel like we're alone. And yeah, that felt like an important thing to do.
I'm out for a short ride with Lee Craigie to chat about her new book, Other Ways to Win. As we now know, it's a memoir and more. Snapshots of a life that has taken her from growing up in Glasgow, feeling uncomfortable that she didn't conform to norms of femininity, through discovering mountain biking, to becoming British champion, and then quitting that system, to working for Highland Council, then quitting that system, to starting her own way of reaching excluded youngsters who also didn't fit in. On her journey, she has raced the Silk Road mountain bike race, the Tour Divide, set the female record for the Highland Trail 550, and more. It's too much to squeeze into one podcast, but fortunately, I already spoke to Lee about a lot of this a couple of years ago. I'm going to re-release that podcast shortly as a part two. There's also a video about my two-day ride to reach Lee and some video from bits of this podcast. Cheekily, I've called it Other Ways to Lee, and that's on the Always Another Adventure YouTube channel. For now, we're going to use extracts from her new book as springboards to our conversation, sat by the trailside in an Aberdeenshire nature reserve, learning about her first big ride into the Campsie Fells.
We all have these moments in our life where everything just sort of slots into place. It feels like everything kind of comes together in one kind of pivotal moment. And that, for me, was probably just the first time, it's happened since, but that was the first time it ever happened. I was really young. I was just a kid, a young teenager. And because I did this big thing, I'd gone for a big bike ride, a bigger bike ride than I could possibly have imagined possible. It changed suddenly this neighbourhood that I knew, I'd known inside out since I was a child. Everything was so familiar to me. I knew like the back of my hand. But because I'd just spent this one day shifting my perception of the world and my physicality and my place in it, it shrunk it. So it everything just looked different. I felt different. And so the world was different. And that really rocked me. You know, suddenly it was almost as though I'd moved from being, I was a child that morning, and then I came back almost as an adult. That sounds a little bit over the top, really. But it was as shape-shifting as that.
Because you talk about how you hadn't really found a place in your femininity, as it were. It was the wrong, you didn't fit the model until that point. And I was wondering how much of it was discovering a place that didn't really need that, if you know what I mean. And you had a role with bikes and a freedom as well.
Uh-huh, yeah. I mean, bikes go on to feature an awful lot in my life. And the bike was really instrumental, but it was much more personal than that. It wasn't my relationship with a bike.
I'm just a mountain biker.
No, it wasn't that. It was here I am in a world that is huge and that I can self-propel through. You know, I have autonomy, I have agency. I'm more than just what I look like or how other people perceive me. There's something huge out there, and it's mine to explore. It's really exciting and really life-affirming, and just such a special moment. I left school and did an HNC in sports coaching and then a degree in outdoor education. So that I guess was like the first part of the journey towards getting National Governing Body Awards in climbing and mountaineering and kayaking and all these things that you needed to work in outdoor centres at the time. So that was like my career direction from a 17-year-old. And then immediately as I graduated, I went to work in Colorado as a technical mountaineering instructor, which is a real step up from the sort of mountaineering and climbing I was doing in Scotland. I was still very young. I was like 20, 21. And here I was in in charge with another instructor of these people that weren't that much older than me, you know, setting fixed lines and guiding these technical peaks. So that was incredible to move through those big wild spaces, again self-supported. There's a theme developing here, isn't there? And then I returned to Scotland and continued working in Scotland in the same capacity. But then I realised that actually my interest wasn't in the focus of teaching people to do the hard things on mountains, although that was great. I was much more interested in their personal process while on the mountain, and I felt like facilitating a personal process felt more valuable to me than teaching them how to tie a bowline. So I went and thought I'll retrain and understand a little bit more about the human psychology and how we learn and how we grow and what our connection to each other and the environment is from a personal point of view. So I did, well, first a counselling skills certificate and then a postgraduate training in child and adolescent psychotherapy, and then tried to weave that into the outdoor stuff, because I was never going to be one of these counsellors who worked in a one-to-one room. That just wasn't ever going to work for me or the young people I was working with. So I saw the two as really, really co-joined. Amicably by, until one day we wake up and wonder where life has gone. I sometimes feel grown-up life can be characterised by saying, after these next few... Got an interloper.
What is that? A little bird?
Oh, yes, a little wren. Is that a wren? On the fern?
It is, it's a wren. With a little...
Wow, she's going for it.
And she's off.
And she's off. Anyway, sorry about that.
No.
Start again.
Most delightful interruption to anything. Usually it's a drill or a jet.
I know, that wasn't a bad one, is it? As interruptions to podcasts. Routine and familiarity can cause our adult days to trundle amicably by until one day we wake up and wonder where life has gone. I sometimes feel grown-up life can be characterised by saying, after these next few weeks, things will calm down a bit. Over and over again until we reach old age. By always taking the easy road or by filling up all the spaces, we give up the opportunity to experience that wonderful moment when fear or boredom give way to exhilaration or understanding. Stepping off that ledge, leaving that shore, giving up that house, that job, these are hard things to do, and made harder still if your bank of fond memories associated with them has swollen with time. But in my experience, it's always been worth it. And leaving my job with the Highland Council was no exception.
We've spoken in the past, on the other podcast actually, about Highland Council and British cycling and all that sort of stuff. Mm. Why is it you don't like systems?
It's not that I don't like systems. Like I know we need order. If we think of it as a continuum, you know, strong systems are at one end and chaos is at the other. We need some sort of order in order to function as a society and in community. But I just think that quite often the systems that we hang our order off, we hold on to them so tightly that we just squash the creativity and the life out of them. I think we have to be really, really careful that we keep humanity at the heart of them. Or decisions get made, we hang on so tightly to process that we forget what it is that we're using the process for. I've seen this again and again, like excellent intentions from government or education systems. But because we're fearful of letting go, of being out of control, we squash the heart out of it. We forget about the humanity, and we don't allow things to evolve naturally or people to thrive or to break out of a narrow mould, because we lose control if we allow that to happen. And I think if we do that, we lose richness, we lose diversity, and we lose creativity. And what a shame.
There were a couple of times reading your book, I thought, ooh, when you were speaking about Highland Council and almost the stagnation that you felt people in you didn't use that word, but it came across to me in classrooms. Mm. Your reaction with some of the systems within British cycling. We've spoken about that in the previous podcast, which I'm going to release as a part two to this, because some of the adventures in there are great. And also we talked about cycle therapy, how you started that and why you started that. But can you just tell me the story of Colin? Because that one seemed to encapsulate an awful lot, right from how people had to get to where this was. You set it up. I don't want to tell the story.
Well, yeah, I mean, that leads on. In fact, Colin's story, I think, perfectly epitomises just what I'm saying about how our systems squash heart and humanity and diversity. So Colin was a boy that I worked with for nearly 2 years through psychotherapy, a one-to-one mountain biking project I set up in the Highlands. And here was a boy who just didn't fit in. You know, he was never going to be part of the economic model. He was never going to leave school and earn lots of money and contribute to the world that is foisted upon most of us. His brain worked in a different way. He had ADHD. He'd been failed by lots of different systems. He'd had some bad luck, and he was in care. He'd been taken into care away from all of his support networks and the people that loved him, and he was isolated and scared, and he'd had lots of things done to him. You know, he'd not been part of the decisions about where his life was going. And he and I worked together to build a bike from scratch, which was pretty cool. We got all sorts of bike parts and an old frame, and he built this bike himself. Incredibly practical guy, really dexterous with tools. And we had a lovely time building this bike together. And then slowly, tentatively, he decided, okay, yeah, I'll go for a ride with you. And over a period of weeks, he understood, as I did, I suppose, when I was about his age, the freedom and autonomy that you can get from a bicycle. You know, he could now suddenly propel himself wherever he needed to go and not rely on the people or the systems that had failed him to take him places, and he wasn't beholden. Until one day, he used that bike to travel a phenomenal distance, actually, like in excess of 20 miles, to get to Inverness from where he'd been put into care. And when I heard that story, I was absolutely blown away that this boy who had been suffered all of these bad blows had the resilience and the wherewithal to ride that kind of distance for love, you know, because he wanted to connect. And this felt to me like an enormous success, a huge thing to celebrate. But it wasn't seen that way, first and foremost, by social services. They thought that this was risk-taking behaviour. And I thought, what a shame that we couldn't reframe that narrative, because this, as far as I was concerned, you know, this is something that he and I had been working, this wasn't risk-taking behaviour, that was well within his capacity to do. He knew that that was within his capacity to do. He'd recce that route, he understood how a bike worked, he knew how to fix a puncture if he got one. He wasn't going to get himself into bother. He made a calculated decision. Colin wasn't a risk-taker, and he'd done this great thing. And instead of celebrating it, he was chastised for it, and we were called in to talk about his risk-taking behaviours. And that felt like a real that felt like a real classic story. This is so often what happens, isn't it? Someone shows a spark of genius or creativity or gumption, or, you know, but if their face doesn't fit, if they're not from the right place, if that's not set up in the right way, if they've not sought permission or they've not been taught by an institution to do this in a certain way beforehand, then it's just not appropriate.
At one school, he'd have got a Duke of Edinburgh's award. And here he's sitting in a case conference with his head buried in his jacket. Yeah. And you trying not to laugh at them for taking it, you know, risk-taking behaviour.
This may be a little bit unfair. Like, the people in that room were
they probably wanted the best.
They wanted the best. They just wanted the best for him. But they came from a different world than I did and Colin did. And they couldn't see it in they could only see it in one specific context, one dimension. They couldn't see it as part of the bigger picture. As far as I was concerned, the bigger picture was absolutely heartwarming.
What are you doing from a work point of view now? Because the active nation thing's come to an end.
Well, not quite. I was 4 years as active nation commissioner, and then the job changed slightly to ambassador for active travel.
Okay.
And I've been a year as ambassador for active travel.
Right.
And that has now almost come to an end as well. It was up until the end of the Cycling World Championships. So I've got a month just to like wrap things up.
Right. So has it been... It hasn't actually been fun.
There's been aspects of it that have been fun, but I'm not sure that the job was ever particularly well thought through and integrated into the policy and strategy of Transport Scotland. There was never a clear vision of how I might be able to actually help or influence. I've always felt like I was kind of kept at arm's length from all that stuff.
Do you think you were seen more as a figurehead than actually someone who might have had ideas?
Yeah. Yeah. I do. I think they wanted somebody with a, you know, an authentic, independent voice to advocate, be an advocate for active travel.
Yeah.
But I think it could have been more than that. I think, and the intention was there. You know, that there were really good intentions there about me helping more marginalised voices to be heard. And but actually, the process of being able to deliver those voices back into government, it was never actually very well thought through.
Achieving success in life is often associated with having money, fame, or influence. But imagine a world where kindness and patience are valued over any other attributes traditionally associated with success. In a world like this, our nurses and support workers would be paid more than our investment bankers and politicians. Now imagine a sporting competition where this might also be true. By the time I was racing in the 2013 British Mountain Bike Championships, I had begun to acknowledge that patience and kindness might hold the secret to better managing the pain that I dreaded so much in the days preceding a race. I had been applying the basic principles of Buddhist philosophy to bike racing, and it was helping me reframe my experience. Pain multiplied by resistance equals suffering. So I had begun experimenting with what happens if I multiply pain with love instead. I can tell you that the result is still a lactic acid buildup, but something else happens too. I know sending out love to counteract resistance sounds far-fetched, especially having described how much I was physically suffering, but I've always been fascinated by the difference between physical and emotional pain. I'd remind myself that my body was designed to function like this, that within it there was a vast vault of wisdom that I would probably never understand, but that I would be okay.
You know, I said about the wren, and now we've got a bloody plane. it's a glider. There's a glider being towed.
Gliding school just over there.
Oh well. Dear listener, if you can cope with having a glider being towed in the background, it's only faint.
Just think of it as a wren.
I'd rather have a wren. What did you mean by all? I think I know what you meant by all that, because obviously I've read more than that. But you know, you've gone on to do some big races. And you've still got the Highland Trail 550 record. And I'm just wondering how... What's the secret, Lee? Share it, go on.
Well, there is no one secret for sure. And
go faster than anybody.
Yeah, just go faster. What are you waiting for? But I think there is something in that. Something shifted in me when I realised, and this is much easier to practice on a long race because it's not just short, sharp, intense 1.5 hour races and you're done. But when you're doing it day after day after day after day, you've got no choice but to make peace with the pain and just accept that this is where you're at. And I think that helped consolidate the learning that I just started to get my head around towards the end of my racing career. Because it hurts so much, like a cross-country race hurts so much. Just every cell in your body is screaming at you to stop, just to back off the pedals, stop pushing. And yet we know that we have to keep going. We have to sort of fight through that. And some days I just couldn't get that pain out of my head and every lap was absolute torture. And other days I noticed that I could manage it better if I relaxed more. You know, if you tense a muscle before you get an injection, then it hurts. If you relax that muscle as you're getting the injection, then it doesn't hurt. And it's the same with everything. Like I do Tai Chi, and that's all about strength and fluidity. As soon as you tense up in Tai Chi, then you'll snap. You don't have that fluidity in motion. Or jiu-jitsu, another, you know, martial art. It's about absorbing an opponent's energy, their blow, and going with that, like using that energy in a different way. And so there was something about not tensing up, about trying to not resist the pain. You're going to feel pain, but there's a way to compartmentalize it in your head and let it go, like let it flow through your body so that it doesn't inhibit your musculature capacity. You know, there's a physiological gain to be had there. But you can't just be like, right, come on, relax. You just can't do that when
smiling
you're...
Smiling helps.
But smiling helps. Yeah, absolutely, smiling helps. Thinking different thoughts help. Not focusing on the bits that hurt and be like, oh, God, this is awful. How am I going to survive another second? But instead, imagining that loosening, imagining a different colour or a different shape moving through that part of your body that's screaming at you, or focusing, like if your quads were burning on a climb, then you switching to focusing on your hamstrings and your glutes instead, and sort of trying to focus on the positives rather than the bits that are hurting. Because it's only a problem. Pain is only a problem if you resist it, like hard things, difficult things are only a problem if you ignore them. That we're always going to come up against this stuff, and it's how you react to those and to what extent you're willing to take them on and breathe and work through them that's going to make you learn, but it's also going to get you through it. And I'm not saying that I nailed it, Simon. Absolutely not. There's still plenty of times where I'm like, this is intolerable. I cannot go another pedal stroke. I am done. But the value on something like the Highland Trail is you're like, okay, well, I'm done. I put my bike down. I'm crying in a corner. Now what? I'm in the middle of absolutely nowhere. I have to get up and carry on. And it's that unknowing and having had experience of being in that position millions of times before. You move through it, it will pass and it will change.
And also adventures often happen when things start to go wrong, when they don't go according to the plan. Yeah. This is just on a much more moderate level, I'm thinking. We've spoken about some of your adventures in the other podcast, which I say will still entirely relevant and will release as a part two to this. But one thing we didn't talk about was the Tour Divide. And that went a bit wrong for you. That the Zen approach didn't really cut it on that occasion. Could you explain to me what went wrong and then, in a way, how it all kind of turned around and went right?
Uh-huh. And so I suppose, ultimately, the Zen approach did work, but not in the way that I'd hoped. Yeah, the Tour Divide was sort of the first time, other than illness and injury, that my body had just shut down, just absolutely ceased to function, and I had to call it. And it was quite a shock to me because I'd always managed to kind of work through that and keep moving forward. But to be reminded that there are limitations, and that was mine, and I reached mine was.
Had you taken too much ibuprofen or something? Was that what was causing
it? It's hard.
You were swelling up, weren't you?
It's hard to
know. Your leg was hitting the top tube.
Everything. Honestly, you should have seen me. I looked like the Marshmallow Man towards the end. Everything was swollen. It was peripheral edema, so my body was holding fluid. There's not very much research gone into it. It happens more in women than it does in men, it seems, when the body, it's a body's trauma response to hold fluid. But it was getting pretty dangerous. And I guess if I'd carried on, then the next thing to happen would have been some sort of level of kidney failure, because my kidneys just weren't flushing out the toxins in my system. And there's schools of thought about what might have caused that. One thing, sir, I was putting my body under a huge amount of pressure by riding the Tour Divide in the first place, but I was putting it under additional pressure by taking a maximum dose of ibuprofen to manage a knee pain that I was experiencing. So it doesn't, in some ways it doesn't actually matter what happened, why I got myself into that position. I couldn't keep moving forward and get myself out of it. I had to stop and get medical attention.
And there were two of you racing, and
that's
you
right.
Quit, your partner carried on.
Yeah.
Your racing partner carried on, and then things went right.
And then things went right. But it's that thing about systems again, isn't it? It's about taking a bird's eye view and reminding yourself what the value is, like what it is that you're doing it for, and what it is that you want to get out of it, and how is it that you want to be in the world. And I realised that I'd been forcing, I'd been pushing too hard. I hadn't been really taking it in. I hadn't been considering my place in this amazing landscape I was moving through. I was just pushing and forcing and racing with a head down. And this setback made me pause, and it was hard. It made me feel really vulnerable. But ultimately what came out of it was I was forced to reframe and to think and step back. And it was very tempting to get on a flight home after that. I could have quite easily just been like, wow, I've failed. I'm not gonna win the race now.
And that would be the racer's response.
In
many ways.
In many ways, I guess that would be, which is still in me. There was definitely a part of me that was like done.
But instead, you managed to catch up again by taking a car ride.
Yeah, yeah. I adapted it. I let go of the purist view of doing the Tour Divide completely under my own steam. I dropped off the route. I used roads, and I got back on the route, and I completed it in a different way, in my way. And in doing so, allowed myself the space to think about what it was for. Like, suddenly it became all mine. I was no longer part of a race against other people. This was just about me and my journey.
So enjoyable in a different way, if not that racing way.
Yeah. And you're still having to move.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Really big miles. But you don't have that kind of that impetus to get somewhere, other than to catch up with Ricky, because we were making a film together. It was kind of gone, and it was up to me, and that felt just gave a different quality, a totally different aspect to the ride, and I was grateful for it. I was really grateful for it. I have a vivid memory from when I was 3 years old of strong arms pulling me onto my mother's smooth knee and being swaddled in a huge, warm, pink dressing gown that smelled of fusty sleep and sweet skin. Inside me, two things were happening at once. I longed to sink into her, to lie back against the full length of her warmth and familiarity, and stay rocking with eyes closed in the dark, airless bedroom. But the fiercely independent wee girl I was then couldn't handle that stifling limit to her freedom. She arched her back in protest and slithered to the cold ground with a sudden, desperate urgency to feel the wind on her face and experience the independence of her own limbs moving. This memory remains a painful and comforting one. painful because that wrenching away from the warmth and comfort of an all-consuming love in order to feel independent and free to roam is a recurring theme in my life. And it felt front and centre of my suffering then in Bishkek. But comforting too, because I knew that the freedom I had created for myself was just around the corner. I had left my partner, my home, my country and my support network. I had done the hard bit. Now I just needed to relax in warmth and comfort for a while. I needed to process my loss. I wasn't ready for the adventure just yet. That time would come, and with it, no doubt, glimpses of joy and contentment. But it wasn't for right now. I didn't realise it then, but this marked a change in the way I'd relate to myself forever. For the first time, I truly understood the precariousness of my capacity for experiencing joy.
Silk Road, mountain race, and you'd left your partner, Virga, and you were wrestling with this, do I want to be by myself, going out and doing things, but how can I have a home life?
Mm.
Have you managed to square that circle? And if so, how?
No. No, I don't think so. I think that is... These are two parts of me that on the surface of it aren't compatible. And I think the only way... I don't think there is a way to square that circle entirely. I think it's a constant dialogue. It's a constant check-in and a conversation that you need to keep having with the people that love you. And I think it's also a reframing of life and how life should be or could be. I think in Western society, certainly, we get hung up on the idea that we need to have a house and a job and a partner and children and...
And an aircraft.
And aircraft.
Yeah. That one's passing overhead, though.
Yeah, that one's...
Yeah. Let them go. More the rules, as it were.
Yeah, the rules. I think if you... There's nothing to say that you need to live within those rules. The complicated thing is if the people that you're trying to live with don't also share that view. You know, if I'm with somebody now who understands that nomadic kind of nature. And there I was in Kyrgyzstan, surrounded by nomadic people. You know, we've not always lived the way we live here. We're supposed to move.
Oh, I hadn't picked up on that, of course.
Mm.
Sorry, yeah, beg your pardon.
Yeah.
Yeah. But do you feel more settled now? Well, I was going to say, do you feel more settled? I wrote that as a question because you've got your dog you had to walk this morning.
Uh-huh.
You've settled with Alice. But there again, I know because I saw on Facebook you've just been in the Alps doing some crazy solo mountain biking thing as well.
Yeah.
So do you allocate yourself some time every year to go off and like this?
So I think the allocation of time is probably fitting into that old model, isn't it? I think Alice and I understand both of us have this same need to feel that freedom and you know, to ask permission to go on a journey. Isn't quite how it works with us. We've got shared responsibilities. We have a home. We have a dog. But there are ways to have these conversations and to share those things and to take us to take each, you know, not to, it doesn't always need to be solo. That little dog can run a long way, and she can go on a cargo bike, and you know she can be part of an adventure, and it's about my adaptation to what an adventure is as well. It doesn't need to be the Stone King Rally through the Alps. It can be 2 or 3 days doing 50k a day, because then I get to take Corey with me and I see the trip differently. So there's other ways to experience an adventure as well.
That's a good point, reframing the adventure. Actually, you mentioned cargo bike. Why don't you talk to me a little bit about the cargo bike thing you set up in Edinburgh? Because cargo bikes were really... big when we last spoke during the pandemic.
Uh-huh.
That was all coming together.
Yeah, cargo bikes were a huge thing. It's still the bike that I use as a runaround. So after Resolution Race, this crazy adventure that four of us undertook, riding each other on cargo bikes from Edinburgh to Copenhagen.
Fully documented in the book.
Fully documented in the book. And in a film, actually, Resolution Race. Yeah. We came back and we had these two cargo bikes just sort of kicking about in Edinburgh, not doing very much. And then the pandemic happened, there was food scarcity. And so we set about helping redistribute that food waste that supermarkets were just chucking in bins to homeless hostel accommodation. And as a result of that, as these things do, it built momentum. And now we've established that project as a charity. It's called Cargo Bike Movement. It has a premises at Toe Cross in Edinburgh. And 40 volunteers every night take a fleet of cargo bikes around supermarkets in Edinburgh and distribute that, what would be food waste, to food banks. And on top of that, you know, we lend out cargo bikes to families or to schools or businesses who might want to consider replacing car journeys with a bike instead. Because, I mean, cargo bikes are not the answer. That is not going to be the solution to climate change, but they're a tiny part of how we can make our towns and cities just more livable in and reduce our carbon emissions. And they're fun. They're so much fun. You know, suddenly what would be a chore in a car around a city centre becomes a pretty joyful experience. And the looks you get when you've got a collie puppy in one of them is also pretty cool. You have to choose between the collie or the shopping. You can't usually take both.
Because the collie eats the shopping.
Because the collie eats shopping, yeah, that's right, yeah.
Oh, imagine that.
I think writing has always been my creative outlet, yep. It was definitely the subject that I enjoyed most in school, more than art or PE even. Yeah, I love it. I love how words can conjure up, it's like a magic trick, you can conjure up emotions in other people by linking a series of words together. And I've always just really enjoyed doing that. It feels like a bit of a jigsaw puzzle, and then I can find the same flow with writing as I can on the bike, and when that happens, you know that you're onto something, and it just feels amazing. It can just feel like, sometimes it can feel like a real struggle, as can the bike. But the extracts from the Highland Trail, for example, I thought about those while I was riding. I almost wrote them in my head while I was riding, and then stopped and they were all still there. It was amazing how I could actually bring back all those words that I'd somehow stored in my brain while I was moving. It felt like a real gift to be able to recall them and write them all down for myself and for other people if they're interested.
Well, I've enjoyed doing this. So do you think you could finish off with a final section? It kind of embraces this person who greets pain with love and goes slower, because slow is smooth and smooth is fast. Just that last little bit, and that'll be ours.
Sure. The bizarre dichotomy of placing myself on a start line in order to practice compassion, patience and gratitude is not immediately understandable. Traditional sports coaches would probably laugh out loud. But what if we were given the time and space to explore other ways to win? And, further to that, consider what winning or success actually looks like. Could a shift away from our growth economy mindset that supports extractivism and social inequality to a well-being economy designed to serve people and planet make more of us healthier and happier? We are hardwired to move faster in the face of adversity in order to escape it. But the faster the world goes, the more important to me the pause between thinking and acting becomes. Perhaps by practicing this pause, I might find that not only do I become happier, but I might also perform better. Maybe in letting go of what I think I know, I might discover there are other ways to win.
I really hope you enjoyed that. Other Ways to Win is published on the 7th of September 2023. It is highly recommended. And if you enjoyed this, remember you can hear more about Lee's adventures in part 2 of this podcast. You can also see some of this one in my YouTube video, Other Ways to Lee. Check out some of the other great cyclists I've had the good fortune to talk to in the Always Another Adventure podcast library. You might consider leaving me a positive review. That would be great. And if you appreciate there being no adverts and all the time and effort that goes into these, perhaps you'll buy me a coffee. There's a link in the show notes to make a tiny payment by way of a thank you. I'm Simon Willis. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.